Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Anne Sterzinger. Anne, great having you back on.
Thanks, Robert. Nice to be here. How are you?
Great. So your latest project is your new website you have with Rachel Haywire, who was recently on the show. It's called Trigger Warning. What gave you the idea to start Trigger Warning?
Oh, well, actually, Rachel started it. She approached me later to join her in it, and it sounded like a fun thing to do. I was kind of between projects, and she was talking about women who are sort of, you know, outside both the paradigm of just sort of the social justice whatever, but also outside of the, you know, sort of bizarre shadow red pill women's movement. She's kind of getting the feeling that women in these milieus kind of want to be the only girl there and kind of want to shit on any other woman who approaches their territory. And we thought, well, that's ridiculously stupid. Why don't we do something together instead of acting like a bunch of high school kids? So she had kind of a unique thing going, and I thought it would be fun to join her. You know, we both have slightly different angles that we're working from, but it kind of comes together to make a good triangulation of something interesting to do. Wow, I'm being really vague.
I think you are being kind of vague.
Yeah. Mostly because we've only put out one issue so far, and we're moving. What I've found from working with online publications is you're really only as good as the contributions you can solicit. So we've decided to move away from, at least for now, to move away from putting out sort of a general focus, a general focus issue like we did for our first issue, and starting to do special issues, which makes it easier to focus on things. If you want me to be more specific about our point of view, it's sort of, well, I'm coming from a radical moderate point of view. After having worked for both left-wing publications and right-wing publications, I've come to the conclusion that to join a team is to chop out half of your brain. So I'm now coming at it from a more radical moderate point of view, which basically boils down to show me the evidence. I really don't give a shit what team you're batting for. I'm interested in facts, but I'm also more interested in satire than essays, really.
Do you want to sort of reach sort of a broader audience as opposed to, well, you're sort of, as opposed to just sort of like the alt-right niche?
Yeah, sort of a broader audience, but at the same time, sort of a narrower audience in terms of trying to cater more to people who are thinkers as opposed to team players and team joiners, if that makes any sense. To tell you the truth, the whole dynamic of the internet as it stands repulses me. People seem to think that, you know, writing an essay that's coming from the most attention-getting angle that they possibly can. I mean, that's the social justice warrior. What do you call it? Tactic in a nutshell. You know, they say the most ridiculous thing they can to get attention. Damn the torpedoes as far as making any sense or using any evidence goes.
And I've noticed with the writers on Trigger Warning, there are a lot of like new people, like people I'm not necessarily familiar with.
Yeah, we're trying to get new people out there. The sort of fact of the matter on the ground right now is we're still in the fundraising stages, and so we're hiring a lot of new writers simply because they're not asking us to pay them yet, which is not the best way to go about things. You get what you pay for, generally speaking. Not that our writers aren't great so far, but a lot of them are inexperienced, and we're happy to get new voices out there. My God, I sound like the unnamed fucking reader, but but even out of new writers, you tend to get better work if they know they're getting paid for it. So we're kind of concentrating right now on being able to pay people. We're launching a fund sourcing campaign the 29th. But what we really want to focus on is getting focused issues together. Our next issue is going to be the dystopian issue, which I'm really excited about because I think what I've sort of been angling at in my God, I'm tired today. But what I've been sort of angling at in the conversation so far is that when people write essays, they tend to puff out their chests and put out the most. They tend to say things in an attention-getting way rather than in a truth-seeking way. And a lot of the time, fiction is truthier than strangeness. People can be less full of shit and get attention when they're writing fiction. So I'm trying to, for this issue, we're calling it the dystopia issue.
The site will be sort of a mixture of fiction stories and articles about nonfiction articles.
Yeah. And there'll be, as the title implied, they'll be focused on sort of a dystopian future. I'm excited about it, but like I said, I've learned from experience that you're only as good as your submission. So we're kind of co-launching the fundraising drive along with the drive to get submissions in hopes that we can get people to really write things that are up to the mark that we want by implying that they will get paid if we can do enough fundraising. So it's kind of a dual-pronged attack to just try to get some good stuff to print because, you know, the whole reason we're doing this is because we don't like what's out there. But we can't do what we want to do alone. We, you know, a two-person website is ridiculous. So we're trying to get the funds and the momentum to get, you know, good contributions.
So one of the articles up there, this is sort of a kind of a Q&A with you and Rachel, but it's the pros and cons of child abuse. Do you see child abuse as a form of implementing antinatalism?
Actually, that piece was mostly satire, and a lot of people are sort of missing the satire. It's kind of a roundabout satire on having kids all together. You know, the point being, if you really want me to boil it down, if you don't abuse their children, they'll be brats, and if you do abuse your children, they'll be brats. So there's really no good way to raise children.
So basically, giving birth in itself is a form of child abuse.
Exactly. You put your finger right on it. And I've taken us to task because they're interpreting that article as being serious. And I think it was Chris Rock who said that comedy is the most serious art form. But we're being serious in a more deadly serious way than people assume when they miss the satire, if that makes any sense.
That's that's kind of like, if you look at comedy, isn't that kind of like Louis C.K. style? Like, he, a lot of the times he's not like your stereotypical like funny comedian. Like, he did this, there's this episode, one of his recent ones, where he was like very depressed and serious, and this other comedian was like really obnoxious and like kind of Louis style is it's like it's comedy, but he's very like serious in his shows. It's all about the situations.
Yeah. The essence of comedy is, you know, laughing so you don't start sobbing hysterically and slit your wrists. That's why cheesy comedy is so bad, is because it's only scratching the surface. It's not going deeper to where comedy meets horror, which is, you know, where the belly laughs actually come from.
And you're not necessarily, I mean, are you necessarily considered a comic writer per se? I mean, does your work, your books fit into a specific genre necessarily?
You know, I try to be a comic writer, but people usually wind up going, Jesus Christ, this is depressing. I mean for it to be comedy. I would love to be P.G. Wodehouse, but for some reason I always sort of go a little too far into goth land to actually fit the comic genre. You know, it's definitely black comedy, heavy on the black.
Yeah, and it's like the kind of books, like, it's not the kind of books you want to read. It's that if you want to just be in a good mood and get out of depression, it's more the kind of stuff, if you want to have like a deeper understanding of life, they're good books to read, but they're not like feel-good books. They're not like books that would be recommended by Oprah's book club.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever be recommended by Oprah's book club. And if you really think Jerry Seinfeld is you know, is really hilariously funny when he does his stand-up, then it's probably not for you. But I guess I'm sort of using jokes as part of a tragic plot. I guess that's the best way to put it. Like, Nisqually, my probably most depressing novel, is definitely using a lot of comic techniques, but the overarching plot is not, you know, nobody gets married at the end. Things don't turn out well in the end. You know, but there are some grotesque belly laughs along the way. I mean, I would say I was inspired by Louis C.K., but I started watching him after I wrote that book. So.
Yeah, I think you did make some. Oh, you made the comparison to Louis C.K. and your experience. I think it was your experience in the Chicago subway.
Oh. Oh, did I? Was that in The Talkative Corpse?
One of your other podcasts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I often feel like him when I'm down in the subway wondering whether, you know, I'll die in a subway track fire today or later.
Louis C.K. got a lot of flack for his Saturday Night Live bit he did about child abuse.
Oh, I didn't see that one. Was he a...
Oh, yeah. You should look it up. It's actually pretty funny. So, you were editor of Tacky Mag for about a year.
Yeah.
And you're no longer editor, but what was that experience like?
It was interesting. Very interesting. After a while... It was more interesting at the beginning than at the end. All the writers have their shtick, and when you're editing the same writers week after week after week, you really get to know their shtick. I do believe they're running without an editor right now. I'm not sure, but
why did you quit?
The thing about it's a long story. I don't want to tell tales. the thing about trigger warning that I'm enjoying is we're doing different things, and we're probably going to have regular features. We're probably going to have regular writers, but instead of, you know, running the same thing week after week, we're gonna do these themed issues, and, you know, sort of force ourselves to not necessarily reinvent ourselves every week, but provide a sort of a surprise menu every week, or, you know, every issue. But eventually we hope to have the financial resources to be able to pay writers to write every week, you know, to have at least a new piece up every couple of days. But for now, we're working with, you know, just launching an issue every couple of weeks and trying to make them themed issues. I've learned from experience now that if you're editing a publication and you can't pay your writers, it's impossible to deal with writers, because no one wants to work for free. I mean, just giving people exposure and prestige, some people will do that, but they're not necessarily the people that you want writing for you, you know? Like people for whom appearing in a publication is good enough aren't the people who have their nose to the grindstone writing and honing their craft and you know, really being perfectionists about it. The people who are going to be doing it at that level are going to want to get paid every week. So you need to have the financial resources and the financial flexibility to be able to offer people money when they come to you with articles. So
when you were writing at Tacky Mag, were there any particular people you especially enjoy working with?
When I was writing there, I wrote about
editing,
a different
editing. You did write there. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, when I was writing there, I wrote about a different author every week. I was writing book reviews, and most of them were delightful, but I never worked with any of them long enough to really get to know what they were in the long term. At Tacky Mag, I really enjoyed working with Kathy Shadel and Gavin McInnes. They were both really fun to edit and really flexible, and, you know, they were responsive and just, you know, they made my job easier, and they were really fun to work with. I know there are some people who can't stand Kathy, and there are some people who can't stand Gavin, and I don't really understand. I worked with them for a year and had no problem with either of them. They were delightful people, you know, but they can have strong personalities, but that doesn't really faze anyone who has a backbone of their own. So, you know. Yeah, they were two of my favorite people ever to edit.
So you were saying you would describe yourself as a radical moderate, and you're kind of talking about how people are forced. They feel in politics, they feel forced to kind of take up a political ideology as if it's a religion, and accept basically every tenet of that ideology, and they become like full-on retards.
Yeah. Yeah, and the sad thing is, it's bad enough when just Joe Blow has to do that, but in the sort of climate of the internet today, writers who are supposedly intellectuals and thinkers are sort of required to do this, because otherwise you can't get an audience. You know, before I worked for talkies, I had a really hard time finding an audience, because people join teams on the internet. You know, the internet is like one big red team and one big blue team, and people join teams, and then they want to read stuff and comment on stuff and be engaged with stuff that flatters them as part of a team. You know, I read the stuff that is part of my ideology that I've accepted wholeheartedly, and if you don't have, you know, I feel more of an affinity for the alternative right these days, because the sort of social justice warriors are trying to run them off the road, and I always sort of like Andy Nowicki, my excellent friend. I've always, he articulates it better than I do, but I've always felt this affinity for, you know, the nerd of the class or whoever is getting bullied or run off the road. But at the same time, I'm not going to subscribe to everything either side says mindlessly, just because I want my fans to know that they can count on me to always say the thing that fits that team and the things we all say together. If you're gonna do that, go home. Why bother? And unfortunately, a lot of writers feel, with a good deal of accuracy in this feeling, that if they don't pick a team and they don't toe the party line, no one's going to read them, because a lot of people are not reading things for intellectual stimulation. They're reading things to feel like they're part of a team. I mean, the extreme example is, you know, I actually find Jon Stewart very funny, but his fans on his show were just so, you know, like, we're part of Team Jon Stewart and everything he says is hilarious and we all cheer in unison. And, you know, he could have told them, you know, let's roast Bernie Sanders on a steak, and they would have been like, they would have hesitated for a few seconds, but then they would have been like, yeah, let's roast Bernie Sanders on a steak. Yeah, Jon Stewart said so. And, you know, I'm obviously I'm exaggerating for a comic effect, but
political writers, I think with political writers, they feel that if they want to be successful, they need to find a political demographic that will support them. And if you're kind of politically an oddball and you're sort of a mismatcher and you pick and choose what views best suit you, then you kind of become like kind of ideologically homeless and you don't have a base. But in your case, you're a fiction writer more than a political writer, even though your fiction touches upon a lot of themes that deal with culture and society.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. If you're politically homeless, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard to find an audience, and I think that's why people sort of press, you know, sort of shave off their own jagged edges to sort of, you know, get into one box or the other. And yeah, writing fiction does open it up a lot for not having to toe the party line. Like, a good example is Nick Mamatis, who I've been told he's a communist, but he doesn't come off anywhere near that stupid in his fiction, because, you know, when you're writing fiction, it's a story. You have the freedom to portray, ironically enough, through fiction, and he writes a lot of science fiction, he's able to portray reality or just the way things are in a more well-rounded way. And he has his basic point of view, but he doesn't have to warp everything he says to shove it into there. That being said, it's a lot harder to get people to read new fiction writers than it is to get them to read just a little, you know, clickbait political article, because a clickbait political article is a lot easier to digest than a new fiction writer that you're not familiar with. And, you know, the themes in political writing are right there, you know, they say it in an essay, whereas the themes in fiction are, you know, you have to do this trick where you write a really entertaining story, and if you actually want to, you know, discuss the nature of reality through that story, you have to sort of mesh the themes with the entertainment. And I actually find that fairly instinctively easy to do, just because I've read a lot. You know, the old advice that, you know, to write well, you have to read a lot, and it's 100% true. But unfortunately, a lot of people aren't reading a lot of fiction. They're you know, just reading each other's clickbait and churning out more clickbait and
well, it's just easy. But people have a short attention span, and it takes a major commitment to get a book and to devote, like, I guess to read a book, like, spread out, it probably could take a whole day. You condense time. It's a big commitment for a lot of people with a short attention span.
Yeah, and it feels like a big commitment, and B, even myself, like, I'm a lifelong book reader, but the more sort of frenetic our hooked into the internetness gets, the less I find that I'm able to read, because I sit down with a book, and across the phone, across the room, my fucking phone is beeping, beep 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 beep. Somebody sent me a message.
Yeah.
I think
it wires people's brains. I think it wires people's brains to have a very short attention span.
Yeah, and I can feel it happening to myself, and it's massively annoying because I have, you know, a shelf full of books that I can't wait to just sit down and be able to digest it. But other people, including old people, like my freaking parents, they're 70 years old, and they're wired in, and they expect, you know, if they send me a text and I don't respond within 20 minutes, they think I'm fucking dead. You know? So, you know, and people that you have social connections with, if you don't respond right away, they get insulted, and you know, and it's just this massive, it's a massive struggle to be able to sit down and read, much less write a book. You know, I've been writing this science fiction novel for 10 years, and part of that is because it's difficult, but I'm like two or three chapters from the end. By the way, anyone who wants to publish it, please get in contact with me. It's almost done. It's amazing. It is a dystopia. We're going to print the first couple of chapters in our upcoming dystopia issue, to which, by the way, everybody should submit articles. And see, look, I can't even stick to one topic for the length of a sentence. Did you hear what I just did there?
Yeah.
I was talking about my short attention span and how long it's taking me to finish my novel, and then I'm jumping ahead to plugging. Please submit to our next. You know, this is what this is doing to our brains. And I'm a person,
like,
who's aware of it.
I'm the same way, like, I'm doing, like, if I could be doing an interview and my mind's just this constant explosion of just thoughts, chaotic thoughts and energy.
Yeah. Yeah, and it feels exciting, but at the same time, once in a while you go, when was the last goddamn time I had three thoughts in a row that were coherent? You know? I've been stuck on the last three chapters of this book, and granted, one of the reasons that I'm no longer at Talkies is because it absorbed my entire life. It was so time consuming, and a lot of that was my own fault because I was very ambitious in wanting to review a book every week, while dealing with writers and editing mass amounts of copy. So that kind of put it on hold. But, you know, the deeper issue is we can't be left alone. We can't leave each other alone long enough to let each other do something that takes up a lot of concentration and sustained concentration. And it makes reading books really frustrating, and it makes writing books really frustrating. But I got to tell you, I have some fresh inspiration for this. I just mentioned Andy Nowicki. He came through town a couple of weeks ago, and he left me this wonderful book called The Savage God by A. Alvarez, A Study of Suicide. The Savage God, A Study of Suicide by A. Alvarez. And it's about...
Is it nonfiction?
It's nonfiction, but it's about fiction writers. It starts with a really long. He knew Sylvia Plath personally, and I've never read Sylvia Plath because you hear the stereotype of her putting her head in the oven, and you think, wow, she must have been a real drama queen. But he goes into her in a way that makes me, you know, I've had The Bell Jar is yet another of those books that I haven't had time to read because my fucking phone keeps beeping and somebody wants this for me and somebody wants that for me. And my dad thinks I'm dead because I haven't talked to him in 10 minutes. I don't talk to my parents that often, but you know what I mean? Like, I'm illustrating the example that even people who are, you know, nearing their 70s and 80s have been caught into this maelstrom. You know, nobody's safe, but, what was
yeah,
I saying?
I think the
only
way to avoid it, the only way really to avoid it is just to go off and, like, live in the woods like the Unabomber.
Yeah, and the thing is, this is a great paradox. To be a writer and to get noticed and to get anyone to read your writing, you have to plug into this thing. But once you're plugged into this thing, you can't read. You can't write. There's always some goddamn thing beeping at you. You have to tend to your little Facebook post to make sure that, you know, Neil Gaiman maybe retweeted you, or, you know, like, oh my God, Neil Gaiman retweeted me and I didn't notice it and I just missed my chance to have an actual career, you know, like, it's that sort of minute to minute, just, and reading this book that Andy gave me, The Savage God, A Study of Suicide, it's so absorbing, and it's about Sylvia Plath's. It takes the melodrama out of it, and it sort of puts you into, you know, a coherent story, and he tells it compellingly, and it's really odd. He's a less famous writer writing about a more famous writer, and I swear to God, his writing about her is better than either of their just plain writing. I find that's actually true with a lot of literary biography. Like, a less famous writer writing about a more famous writer can be more compelling reading than either of their fiction or poetry or whatever put together. I don't know why that is, but...
Would
you
say, you
know,
in general, a lot of the best artists are less famous because they don't have the access to mass publishing and they don't have the skills to promote their books on a large scale?
Oh, I think that's unfortunately very true. I mean, it's exaggerated now with the internet, but even back then, there are two different skill sets. There's actually writing, and there's, God damn it, somebody is honking outside my window. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. They're worse than the internet. There are two skill sets. There's actually writing, and then there's promoting yourself as a writer and making your list. You know, it used to be going to cocktail parties. Now it's hanging out on Twitter. But it's the same bullshit. And they're both skill sets that sort of depend on verbal skill. But once again, writing is that sustained attention, that ability to develop an idea and, you know, give the reader something of substance, whereas the skill set that gets you famous is, you know, sound bites and you know, back then cocktail parties, but now it's, you know, manipulating Twitter and knowing how to, you know, write clickbait, you know. I would say It makes me want to finally read The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath, reading A Study of Suicide. But it makes me more interested in writing the less well-known A. Alvarez's work because, you know, he has his flaws, but his way of writing about her is more compelling than anything by her that I've actually read. Granted, she didn't make her name by... doing a lot of cocktail parties. She made her name by sticking her head in the oven, which, you know, good on her. That's commitment.
Yeah.
You know, that's not being annoying jackass who's always on Twitter. That's damn, you know. Maybe she wasn't as compelling of a writer as he is, but she really put her neck on the line.
One writer who's become fairly prominent now, who I guess people who I'd say does have similar themes to your writings as Michel Houellebecq.
I love him. It took me a while to get into him because I was originally introduced to him through his poetry, and I have to confess, I am a bit of a Philistine as far as poetry goes. You know, big gap in my education. But when I started reading his novels, I was kind of blown away. I actually came to him late enough that I wouldn't call him an influence, more of a confluence. You know,
I guess it's a coincidence, like the same with you and Andy. Like, you're not necessarily influencing each other, but you have these minds that, like, just think alike, but have never been exposed to each other previously.
Right. Yeah, well, in the beginning, anyway. Now he and I, you know, we correspond regularly. I see him whenever he comes through Chicago. So now we are probably influencing each other. But yeah, when we first met, it was definitely just, there's somebody who thinks a lot like I do, sitting in Georgia somewhere, or, you know, in Houellebecq's case, in France somewhere.
You were saying you interact with Andy. You weren't talking about you don't interact with Houellebecq.
No. I was talking about Andy. Sorry, I got confused there. Yeah. Right before you. I called you. I woke up from a much needed nap, so I'm still not quite firing on all cylinders. For the listeners' benefit, I've been moving recently. Not really. I didn't choose to move. I had to move, and I'm just my brain is even more disjointed than the internet makes it to begin with. This book that Andy lent me about Sylvia Plath, and just this compelling theme of suicide in literature, which, you know, does show up in my work. Not to give readers any spoilers, but it does show up in my work, and I find it a compelling theme. I've been exhausted. I just finished moving, and I kind of turned off my phone and sat down and read this book because it was really compelling, and it's making me feel like, okay, once I get all my shit put away and my life settles down and I'm not having these crazy couple of months, and I'm, you know, Takis was a great experience, but it was very, very, very time-consuming. And trigger warning is, it's a little less intense right now. You know, we're just getting it going, which is kind of labor intensive, but it's not that daily newsroom grind. So I'm able to, you know, I've read this really inspiring book. My life is calming down a little bit, and I'm in a place where I can settle down and go, okay, I'm going to push through to the finish line. But it's going to take a lot of turning off my phone and people getting pissed off at me, which is fine. I probably could have picked better timing, because on top of, you know, our fundraising drive for Trigger Warning and our drive to get submissions for the Dystopia issue, which everybody's welcome to submit to. Go to the site and you will find our email address there. I also just released my translation of Octave Mirbeau's Dans le Ciel in English translation for the first time ever. I'm the first person to ever translate Mirbeau's Dans le Ciel into English, which translates as In the Sky. And he's kind of well known. His most famous work is Diary of a Chambermaid, or I forget how they translate it in English. I think it's Diary of a Chambermaid. Or Journal d'une femme de chambre. I think that's what they translated as, Diary of a Chambermaid. And it's quite well known. He was an anarchist in the 19th century, around the turn of the 20th century. And he also wrote The Torture Garden. A lot of people in my literary circle really love the Torture Garden. But for some reason, nobody has ever translated In the Sky before. And this is a 15-year-long project. I translated it 15 years ago before I actually went and got a French degree. And then I had to retranslate it when the project got going again because my original translation was a piece of shit. You actually learn things in 15 years, believe it or not.
We were touching upon a little bit about your ideology, and you were saying you're not optimistic enough to be a libertarian or a socialist. You just like to see big government and big business snipe each other in the back.
Exactly. That's kind of how I see it. I'm not exactly a nihilist. Nihilist kind of means that you don't care. Little bit chaotic. I'm just not much of an optimist. I would love to see things. I would love to see people do well and things go well. It's just I don't think I. Rachel was briefly involved in transhumanism, and I just look at that and go, that's a nice fantasy. Also unicorns. And the sort of the libertarian ideal that, you know, everyone can treat each other fairly and have a free market. It's wonderful. I love listening to Stéphane Molyneux's podcasts and thinking, yeah, wouldn't that be nice? But both libertarians and socialists tend to assume that people don't cheat.
Well, they're naive about human nature. I mean, with the left, the left thinks they can re-educate people to be tolerant and all that stuff through like education. And with libertarians, they think people are good. It's just that government is bad. But once you remove government, we'll be good to each other.
Right. The problem with the problem with the socialist point of view is that they're just insane, and the sort of double think that it takes to just ignore Pol Pot is sort of mind bending. But the problem with the libertarian point of view, as you just sketched it out, is, well, people are good except for, you know, the government is bad. But who makes the government? You know, government should be made up of people, right?
Yeah, I mean, the politicians are lousy and they're elected. I mean, people still elect them. It's not like there's the politicians are bought off, but the government's a product of the people and the culture. You can't just say that the society is good and the government's bad. That's totally idiotic.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have a great affection for libertarians. It's just you guys, that's so cute. I love that idea. I really wish it would work. But, you know, people love to form governments, you know, and people love to form power structures. And the idea that you can somehow stop them from forming them is, well, of course, I'm talking about Stéphane Molyneux because he's my favorite libertarian. But he has this lovely idea that if we don't spank our children and we don't abuse our children, that, you know, at some point in the far future, we'll just have a libertarian society, and it'll just happen because people won't be, you know, lusty for power anymore because they haven't been spanked and they've been raised peacefully. And I mean, I hope he proves me wrong, but I would be very surprised if that happened.
And the other point you make is you talk about it's kind of hard to be a libertarian. Sometimes when you see, like, all these obnoxious, like, spoiled rich kids who, like, inherit all their wealth, sometimes it kind of makes you, like, want to be a communist.
Yeah, or at least cut off Aunt Marie Antoinette's head. I actually have heard a really good counter argument to that, which, you know, makes me feel better. not that what I feel means anything to the inner workings of the inner or outer workings of the universe, but it is true that most spoiled brats wind up just screwing everything up for themselves. You know,
maybe that's just like wishful thinking.
Yeah. There was somebody on my Facebook page, because, you know, I dutifully go on social media because I want people to buy my damn book. Somebody was engaging me in a conversation about that. And he was just a tiny bit condescendingly, because maybe he fancies he's older than I am. It's funny how everyone fancies they're older than I am and they're like 30. you know, you'll find out later in life that all these kids who started out of the gate ahead fall behind because they screw themselves up, and then I'm like, yeah, but, you know, not all of them. And it's kind of like
the fantasies, like there's fantasies in movies that make people feel better, like the cliche where the nerds end up being successful and the bullies or the popular crowd in high school end up being losers, like. There are fantasies that are put out, like, in pop culture to make people feel good, but it's not, like, the case in real life.
Yeah. I read some study somewhere that, like, yeah, the people who are popular in school usually doing pretty well when they're 50. Those social skills, that social aptitude, if that's a word, as opposed to ineptitude, and just the willingness to be aggressive and cruel, you know, that doesn't go away. That serves people throughout life.
Yeah, and I guess it's part of mindless entertainment, but maybe it is kind of social conditioning to make people accept things the way they are rather than trying to change it. So maybe there is an agenda.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of things that look like agendas are just sort of this mysterious outgrowth of culture. Like I was thinking today, as I was reading the Sylvia Plath book, later it goes into how the conception of suicide changed in Christianity. At the beginning of Christianity, they were fanatic about suicide because being a martyr and getting the Romans to kill you meant you would go straight to heaven. So there were so many, you know, the idea that the Romans were just cruelly slaughtering these Christians is kind of a myth. The Christians were sort of pestering the Romans to kill them because being martyred by the state was an easy way to get into heaven. Because and you know, the ideology worked that way at the time because most Christians were slaves, they were poor people. But later when Christianity became sort of a ruling class ideology, suicide became taboo because to kill yourself meant to deprive the state of taxes or your labor. It's not necessarily that the upper classes deliberately, you know, sneakily change the ideology in order to crush the lower classes, because this ideology applied to them too. You know, no matter how miserable they were, it was a sin to kill themselves, even though 1,000 years earlier, if you killed yourself, you know, by antagonizing the Romans, you'd go straight to heaven. You know, it's not like somebody always consciously decides to propagandize these things. It's almost this creepy way that culture itself propagates itself at the expense of humans. You know, it's sort of like a third organism.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway. Like a lot of people are into like conspiracy theories, but I'm skeptical of conspiracy theories. I just think that culture. I basically what you're saying, that culture in itself becomes its own organism. But
yeah.
I want to ask, you were recently in France, and this was around the time of the Charlie Hebdo massacre, and you wrote an article about this at Tacky Mag, so you were in one of those Muslim, what are they called, like no-go zones?
Yeah, that I was making fun of the pants pissing exaggeration of no go zones. I mean, I went in there. There were plenty, and you know, the idea that cops can't go in there and shit is constantly on fire, and you know, I went in there. I walked around. Some people were nasty and ridiculous, but you know, I didn't get killed. Plenty
so you're
of French
you're
people.
Not saying you're not saying that. Muslims overrunning Europe is a great thing. You're just saying that those areas, they're no worse than, like, the Bronx in New York or South Central LA.
Yeah. Like you know, there are parts of Chicago that are, I mean, yeah, any urban center in America has areas that are much, much worse than that. And just, like, For Americans to be flipping out over, oh, this part of France, you can't even go in it, and this shit's constantly burning, is ridiculous. We have so, you know, we have much, much, much worse neighborhoods here. You know, that being said, there is a certain, you know, sort of hostile takeover of French soil by people who hate French people. I don't understand it. If I hated a country, I would not move there. That would be the last place on earth I would move. But, you know, some people just like to make themselves miserable as long as it can make someone else more miserable.
Do you think the Muslim problem in Europe, do you think it's exaggerated? Or did you notice, like, a huge problem in Muslim presence when you were there?
You know, it's really hard to apprehend something that statistical when you're just walking around. If that makes any sense. You know, my perceptions were altered by what neighborhood I happen to be in. You know, there are neighborhoods in Paris that look like it's 1950. There are neighborhoods in Paris that look like you're in Beirut. No, well, that I'm exaggerating for comic effect, but you know what I mean. You know, and there are plenty of French Muslims who are perfectly well assimilated. I guess I wasn't over there long enough, and I'm not adept enough with statistics to give you a really accurate big picture. There were places where I felt uncomfortable walking at night, and that's a first. I've never, you know, 20 years ago, I never felt uncomfortable walking alone at night in Paris. Now there are places that are becoming somewhat analogous to some neighborhoods in Chicago. You know, you still don't have, you know, the sort of shootings and whatnot, but yeah, things are changing. I honestly can't make any prognosis on that. I think you know, earlier immigrants like Eric Zemmour and Alan Finkielkraut are sort of pushing back against this, you know, trying to lead by example and saying, you know, they're trying to lead by example and saying, yeah, I'm a son of an immigrant, but I don't hate France. I mean, that's what it boils down to. If you hate being in a country, you know, you're going to make life unpleasant for yourself and others. Then again, you can't really, it's hard to blame second generation immigrants for what their parents did. You know, there's some place that they don't like, and their parents dragged them there. I don't know why they're taking it out on French people instead of on their parents, but, you know, some sort of perverse twist on being a teenager, I suppose.
What do you think about the sort of like stereotypes about, like, French people being rude? Do you think
Americans,
you're actually saying you think Americans are a lot more rude?
Well, all people are rude, but I think it's really silly to say that French people are more rude than other people, because if I had to say, I'd say they're less rude than other people. I'm always it's a very easy country to get along in, by and large, if you just, you know, you have to learn the language and you have to be friendly yourself, you know, just.
So you don't walk up to someone and shout at them and say, "Where's the Eiffel Tower?" in, like, English?
No, you don't do that. Because, you know, when I'm downtown in Chicago and I'm in a rush to get somewhere and a German tourist comes up to me and starts asking me where shit is in German, I'm kind of rude. I kind of shove by them. I kind of ignore them. I think.
But, they would speak in English. Americans have this sense of entitlement that everyone in the world should speak English. I mean, on one hand, we have we have voter information in foreign languages, and we don't we let people come here and kind of do what they want. But on the other hand, American tourists who go abroad go to Europe and expect everyone to speak English.
Yeah, well, actually, I think that's gotten better in recent years. I haven't really seen any. The last time I was there, I didn't really see any ugly Americans. I saw a lot of ugly Chinese and ugly British people. The stereotype that the French hate American tourists is starting to not be so true anymore. They're kind of busy being sort of dreading the Chinese tourists and I wouldn't call the English abroad tourists, really. They go to bars and start fights is kind of what the English do abroad, which isn't really tourism. It's just kind of doing what they do in a different country for God knows what reason they have for doing that. But.
And also what were you saying is that if you travel, if you're a foreigner, people actually cut you some slack for not being socially adept.
Yeah, which is really great. You know, I'm not the most socially adept person on earth when I'm in quote unquote my own element in the United States. So it's really refreshing to have an excuse for being awkward. You know. No, I'm American. In America, we always have our skirts tucked into our pantyhose. It's normal, you know.
What are your thoughts on self-publishing via Amazon? And as Amazon, that's something you've been doing, and Amazon has it enabled a lot of independent writers to get their work out there.
It's a really great way to be able to launch a book with low overhead. What I have found, though, is that you're still responsible for publicity, which is not my strong suit. So I need to work on that personally. But as I was ranting before, any hour you spend on publicity is one less hour that you can spend writing. So personally, I need to find a balance with that. Unfortunately, one also has to make a living, which I've been doing writing just clickbait about nutrition freelance. That's how I've been raking in money lately. And it's really hard to get the time to get your actual writing over the hump where you can make a living at it while you have to keep, you know, you have to divide your time between making, you know, paying the rent, actually writing, and then publicizing your writing. And it's a really, it's a balance that I struggle with. And you know, a lot of people's attitude is very, 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 very 21st century. and that if you aren't adept with social media, then your writing doesn't deserve to be read anyway, because you're not really a writer if you're not doing all this shit that isn't writing, which strikes me as something that people in 50 or 100 years are going to laugh at us for. I'm hoping I get the last laugh. That would be nice.
So your next book, I guess you can plug this, it's a science fiction novel. So I guess your previous book, not Nussquam, The Talkative Corpse, is sort of a science fiction novel, But I mean, what is it like trying to work to write science fiction? Would you say is it more difficult than your other writings?
Yeah. Well, the thing about I had the idea for this science fiction novel probably about 15 years ago, but when I sat down to write it, I realized I'd only written short stories, and I needed to write a couple of more realistic novels, just get the practice, just developing characters and making a plot arc and doing all the things that you need to do in a sort of point-and-shoot novel, you know, to actually write science fiction well as opposed to just churning out pulp, which unfortunately there's so much bullshit that gets churned out that it gives science fiction a bad name. The science fiction format can do such great things, but so many people abuse it by not actually learning to write first. And you really do kind of need to write some point and shoot stuff first, just to get those skills in place before you add, you know, like, you learn to juggle three balls before you throw in a fourth ball. And the fourth ball is, oh, now let's create a universe. You know, let's create a whole different world. And it's really hard to throw that ball in until you already know how to juggle the other three balls and keep them in the air. So, Nussquam started out as just practice so that I could get to this science fiction novel, but then it became sort of a compelling thing to write in its own right. It's probably my favorite. It's still my favorite thing I've written so far. But I think I'm actually going to like Life, L-Y-F-E, which is the working title of my science fiction novel. I think I'm actually going to like that more than Nussquam once I get it finished. But Nussquam turned from a practice exercise into something that was really compelling to write in and of itself.
So I guess the next time I'll have you on will be this will be talking about your new book, Life, when it comes out.
Okay, cool. I said my new book right now is the translation of Octave Mirbeau, In the Sky, which is just out on my usual publisher, Nine Banded Books with Chip Smith, and it was an amazing book to begin with. I hope I did it justice. I spent an embarrassing number of hours trying to get it just so. And people tell me it's a great translation. I hope they are correct.
So, Ann Sturzinger, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me. Sorry I was half asleep when we started, but, you know, that's how it goes.
So, should I title the show the Ann Sturzinger Half Asleep?
Yeah. Listen to a half asleep person babble about Sylvia Plath.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
See ya.